This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Roland Kays has spent the better part of his life studying animals, but his career in zoology might actually have started in a high school physics class. You see, at that age, Roland was convinced that he wanted to be a genetic engineer. So when the time came to present a physics project, Roland instead convinced his teacher to let him do a biology experiment. He wanted to see what would happen to fly eggs if they were exposed to radiation. Of course, his high school didn't have an X-ray machine lying around, so Roland goes to the airport and asks to use their X-ray machine. And that experiment might not have yielded the result that he wanted, but it was pretty clear that Roland would do what he needed to do to study natural sciences. Today, Roland Kays is an accomplished zoologist with a number of expeditions under his belt, including trips to Africa and South America. In 2013, he was part of a team that discovered a new relative of the raccoon called the olenghito. He is now director of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences Nature Research Center and an associate professor at NC State, where he teaches mammalogy. And Roland Kays joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Yeah, so thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about that fly egg experiment.
The fly egg, yeah. That was fun. Well, I was really interested in DNA and had this idea that you could do an experiment and then see the results in the DNA. So I ordered up, you know, from the back of a Boy Scout magazine or something like that, these fruit fly eggs, and reared them up and had them growing in my basement. And then my dad and I went down to the Detroit airport and had this little brown paper bag full of vials that we ran through the X-ray machine various times.
Because back then, coming to the through security with a vial full of nondescript material was just perfectly okay.
Yeah, it was all right. They you know, I think by the time I ran it through 20 times, they were getting a little sick of me. And I do kind of remember getting chased out at the end. But
what did you say to them to get them to do this?
We just explained what we wanted to do. And we weren't at the main giant airport. This is a smaller metropolitan airport in downtown Detroit. So they didn't have a lot of business. They were just kind of hanging around, and they were happy to help us out to up to a point.
Yeah, up to a point. So about run 20 or 21.
20 was my biggest exposure that we ran back and forth 20 times, and at that point, they were getting kind of sick of it.
All right, so then back you go to the lab to do your DNA experiments at your high school lab, and oh no.
Yeah, well, I had this idea that I would look and I would see mutated DNA. So I actually did a DNA extraction, which I think it worked, but when you extract DNA, you just get this sort of glob of snot. Mm. And you know, now as a scientist who does study some DNA, I understand what you need to actually analyze that, and it's basically a whole bunch of chemistry and fancy machines. And I didn't have any of that in high school, so I put the snot under a microscope and looked at it, and it just looked like snot.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the end of that.
So I think this fruit fly should be a nose at some point. So now, all right, you're stuck there. You realize that you don't have all the tools you need to do the DNA analysis, but you can do some observations, and you did.
I had a poster for a science fair that I had to finish. So I wrote up the poster and did that and was getting ready to present it, and I just kind of stashed the fruit flies up in the side. And what I'd found was that the one that I'd run through 20 times, I thought they died because nothing ever hatched out. But actually, after I did the poster, the flies started hatching out. And so they were actually still alive, but they had been slowed down a great amount from the radiation.
So that's a good observation, and there's a lot of good science that comes out of that.
It was, yeah.
Making an observation. Also, they were 300 times their size, and they conquered Detroit, and no.
I was definitely looking for, you know, the nose growing out of the leg or, you know, some kind of weird mutation like that, and I didn't see that. You know, probably the ones that actually got the mutations didn't survive at all.
Was that a moment for you, I mean, when they actually hatched? I mean, obviously, you do your report, you make the poster, but when you saw that they hatched and you now had a result, those that were radiated took longer to hatch. Obviously, many questions arise from that. Was that kind of a big moment for you?
Well, it was a big surprise, and I think, you know, a lot of times science is surprises, and you find things that you didn't plan for, and that was one where I had kind of stopped paying attention to them. Right. I didn't throw them away, but I had them stashed up on the top of a drawer or a top of a shelf, and I went back after it all, and I think I was going to go throw them away, and oh wow, there's actually flies in here, so yeah. I actually, you know, probably should have paid a little more attention to them
and followed up on those guys. Well, anyway, you go to college, you went to Cornell, and you realized, I think at that point, that you were headed toward environmentalism. journalism or environmental science?
Well, no, it was actually the summer after my freshman year. So I went in as a freshman and took all the basic science classes, chemistry 101, bio 101, all those kinds of things. And I was still really interested in this genetic engineering thing and this idea of doing work in the lab and for some kind of greater good. And then I actually spent the summer working at Wayne State Medical School in a lab, and I found it completely exhausting, spending all day long in a lab. And I was a wrestler in college, so I was in shape, but to sit down at a lab bench all day long was just kind of exhausting. So when I went back to Cornell as a sophomore, I sort of started thinking, well, what else in science can I do that's not in the lab all day long? And I had always been a bit of a nature nut. I'd always just running around the backyard, running around the woods, going out with Boy Scouts. And so at some point around that point, I started thinking, well, is there some way that I can combine these? And the class that was offered that fall was mammalogy. And so I took it, and it was great, and now I'm a mammalogist. And I kind of wonder, you know, a lot of times these ology classes, whether it's ichthyology, study of fishes, or entomology, these different ologies are taught once every couple of years. And so I kind of wonder if herpetology had been taught, if I'd be studying turtles and salamanders right now.
Well, you did just stick with mammals, and you hit the road. When did you start doing field work and get out into the
environment? Well, right away, as an undergrad, there was the professor had Professor Deidre McLaren, who's actually now at Duke and in the area, she had me out running traps for small mammals out in a forest outside of Ithaca with a whole bunch of other undergraduates. So there was lots of students to learn from and get out there and learn some of the mammals and learn some of the techniques and the science.
And did you decide then that you liked field work? Obviously, this is very – and you talked about being a wrestler. So, you know, sort of being active and kinesthetic, getting yourself out there in the woods.
Yeah, totally. That's always like been – right? You know, right away I loved – you know, even we had these – I remember these midnight trap checks where it's like raining on us, but I still kind of thrived on that and liked the adversity and the fact that you could go out there and if you worked harder outside, you would get better data.
We are meeting Roland Kays today on The State of Things. He is the director of the Biodiversity Lab at North Carolina's Museum of Natural Sciences at the Nature Research Center. There was also, I mean, there's part of it is just the raw science and studying mammals, in your case. But you were also interested in environmentalism. I think there was a government, something happened that the government sort of sanctioned the removal of old growth forest in Alaska or something. Is that what part of the thing that grabbed you at
the
moment?
I think, you know, as a kid, I'd always been enjoying nature. And when I grew up a little bit and started realizing that some of these natural areas were threatened, then it got me upset. And so, you know, as a kid, I didn't really realize that. But I think as I, you know, as I went to college, and the one that I remember first was seeing that there are these old growth forests, which are special because they're so old and they're very unique, and they have different animals and different trees and these giant redwoods. And then hearing that they're publicly owned, but that the government was basically, you know, selling the rights for loggers to cut these unique resources. And the thing that really got me was that actually they were selling it so cheap, and the government was actually putting in the roads to help them do it, that we were actually spending tax money to help them log those forests. And that was kind of the first thing that was the same time where everyone was talking about, oh, the rainforest is getting chopped down like crazy. I think that was sort of starting to creep into everybody's mind up here as well.
So you start by studying the wilds of suburban Ithaca, New York, but you moved on. What was your first kind of exotic field experience?
Yeah, well, I got to do some work in Panama, and then later that same year in French Guiana. So those were two trips down into the tropics to see, this was one of the things that got me excited, was that this was kind of a frontier, because there's not as much work down there, so there's more stuff to be discovered. And in particular, I was drawn to the canopy of these forests, which is even more the frontier, because it's hard to get to. And so there's all these animals up there that had almost never been studied, that we knew very, very, very little about. But it was challenging, because you had to climb the trees, you had to run around. You know, for some of the work I did, I had to run around the forest at night by myself with a headlight. And so, you know, I kind of liked the physical challenges and this idea that there was a frontier that was yet to be explored.
What were you doing in Panama?
In Panama, so I ended up doing my PhD research on an animal called the kinkajou, which is it lives in Panama. It lives in basically all the rainforest from Mexico to Brazil, all throughout South and Central America. And it only comes out at night, and it only climbs up in the trees. And so it's this really cool animal. It's got to be one of the cutest mammals out there. It's about the size of a cat. It can hang by its tail. And it climbs around in these trees at night, which is really amazing. So I would go out, I would trap the animals, give them a radio collar, let them go, and then I would truck around at night with a headlight, following them around, trying to figure out what they were doing.
What did you find out about them that we didn't know?
Well, one of the things it was I confirmed about their diet, because people had said they ate just about everything, and actually I found they eat almost 100% fruit. They're one of the most frugivorous animals in the whole world. Which is interesting because they're related to raccoons and other carnivores. So they shifted over a long evolutionary history from a diet of meat and frogs and insects and stuff like that to this specialized fruit diet, which makes them more like a primate. They're climbing around the trees. They're eating fruit.
Right.
And there's a lot of research into primate social systems and why do primates form groups? Why do we as primates, you know, we're such a social animal? And so kinkajous actually have an interesting group structure that was cool to compare with primates because they're not a primate, but they live like a primate. So you could see how this fruit diet and some of the aspects of the predators that they had or did not have affected the way that they form groups.
So it really is a window onto adaptation and how complicated it is. Social structure, environmental change, all of that kind
yeah,
of contributes.
But also how when you have things that are totally unrelated, like primates and kinkajous, but they end up going in the same direction and having the same social system, you start to understand what drives that.
My guest today is Roland Kays, director of the Biodiversity Lab at North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, also a research associate professor at NC State. And we will continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with zoologist Roland Kays. He's the director of the Biodiversity Lab at North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. He's also an associate professor at NC State. We're talking a little bit about your research and your work after you while you were at Cornell and a little bit afterward. But also, you talked about wrestling. Did that have much of an impact on your career or your outlook on what it is you do now?
Yeah, I think... It definitely did. And, you know, sort of boiling it down, one of the most important things was when you step on a mat to wrestle your opponent, it's just you, right? I mean, you're part of a team, but if you win or lose, you can't blame it on the goalie, or you can't blame it on the offense or the defense or the coach or anything else. It's just you and that opponent. And so and you can make excuses in your head. And I did sometimes, you know, I'd say, oh, well, you know, I have a tweaked ankle or, you know, I didn't sleep very well last night, but that doesn't matter in the end. You lost.
Right.
And I think seeing that sort of later in life that you can always find an excuse to not succeed at whatever it is that you're going for, whether it's a wrestling mat or keeping up with the kinkajou all night long or writing a paper in time or getting a grant done. But you know the fact is at the end of the day you either did it or you didn't. You either succeeded or you didn't. And I think that sort of helped me to keep a focus and to not let excuses creep in. And end up, because once you accept an excuse, then you're done. Then you've failed at whatever it is.
And you'll keep doing it, most likely, because it was a very comfortable excuse. So that explains a little bit of sort of your personal drive and your work ethic and all of that. But science, very collaborative, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I don't view, my science as stepping on a wrestling mat and trying to beat somebody. It's very much a group effort, a team effort. And that's one of the things I really like about it is the collaborative aspect of it and working with students, especially at NC State, or, collaborators all around the world, no matter where you're working. And that's so much easier now with the internet and email and all these things. I mean, you really can write papers with people and share knowledge with people all around the world, sometimes without even seeing them.
What brought you to North Carolina?
I came down when the Nature Research Center opened at the museum and was excited about this possibility of a joint appointment. So in the before this, I worked at the New York State Museum, which was a great place, but it was just the museum part and not the university part. And so this has the combination of the two. So I teach at NC State. I advise students. I have a lot of undergrads working in my lab. And then there's also this totally ridiculous lab that I run at the museum, which is has glass walls and is on exhibit. And so it's this new way to bring science to the public and to try to share what we're doing and try to get people actually involved in the science.
You also do video classes with high schools, right?
Yeah, yeah. So we so one of the emphases at the museum is communicating science, and so being a good a good lecturer, getting the message across, writing blogs, but certainly making videos is part of that. So I really like making videos myself. I've worked with a number of other film crews doing that, and also started working with NC State students to sort of show them, try to have the graduate students and the undergrads who are learning the science to not forget how to translate that back to non-scientists.
And how to do some of the very practical day-to-day things that one would have to do if you're a mammalogist. So one of the things you would have to do is to preserve specimens so that you can see them over time, perhaps how they've changed, preserve them for scientists in the future. And that takes a little bit of work, which means you have to know how to skin a squirrel, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we've done a video on how to skin a squirrel. That was great fun with Rob Nelson at Untamed Science. And we do that right in the window. So people who are at the museum, they can see museum staff or students. Often we're preparing specimens for the museum.
All right, listeners, put down your crostini. Here is a sample of that very video.
The first stage when you're making a museum specimen is the data stage. You need to know where the animal came from. You've got to figure out what species it is. So these are both fox squirrels. Take the measurements, and you got to write all this down on a piece of paper. Usually if you pinch it up, you make like a small cut sideways and then cut up the sides. All around, you go through the leg, you get the other leg out, pull the tail out so that the tailbone, all the vertebrae there are out.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, no. What's that? The tail?
That's the tailbone. Oh, my goodness.
And then you pull the skin on up the back, work the two forearms out, and then you have the head as the last bit. You've got a clip at the ears, clip at the eyes, and then finally clip at the nose, and then you have the skin on one side and the carcass on the other. We want someone to be able to come back in 50 years, in 100 years, in 500 years, and look at the specimen, take measurements if they need, maybe take some samples if they need to do tests, and basically use this animal like a time machine to see what the world was like in 2014.
All right, now back to your lunch. That was my guest, Roland Kays, explaining how to skin a squirrel for preservation at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Roland is the director of the Biodiversity Lab at the museum and a research associate professor at NC State. So how much data does a museum like the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences have in its drawers?
Well, we have millions of specimens across the board. When you consider the insects and the reptiles and the amphibians and the fish and all the different areas that we keep collections. In the mammal world, we have about 15,000 specimens that are preserved.
Just in North Carolina, just in Raleigh. I mean, you're talking about, or you're saying the scientific community or
no,
the
no,
museum?
Our collections. Wow. At the museum in the basement. So, a few of those are on exhibit, and we bring some of them out. So we've just opened up the extreme mammal exhibit, and we brought some out to show some of the science that goes on. But a lot of them are not, not out on display, but they're available for research. We give out loans all the time. We have especially, these days, these genetic samples are super important. So we get a lot of people interested in just little tiny bits of tissue that they can use for genetic analysis.
Well, and this is interesting because now you really, while there's still a lot of research that goes on in exotic and hard to reach places, you can do a lot of research at other museums, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of discoveries that are made just by going through old museum drawers. In fact, that's where our Olinguito study started, was looking through some old specimens and open up a drawer and seeing, why is there a red animal? There are no red animals described of this group. And that was the first hint that we had a new species there.
Tell us about that, the Olinguito. We talked about it when it happened back in, it was 2013.
Yeah.
But remind us about the Olinguito.
Yeah, so my colleague Chris Helgen, who's a curator at the Smithsonian, he was evaluating a group of animals called the Olingos. And just trying to figure out how many species there were, because about 100 years ago, a variety of taxonomists around the world had described too many. Everyone knew there probably weren't five or six different species. So he was just going through and trying to figure out, were there one or two? And in the process, most of the Olingos are kind of brownish or grayish. And he opened up this drawer at the Field Museum in Chicago, and this old specimen, about 100 years old, there was this small red one that had really, really long fur. And he's like, well, this is weird. And then he saw that on the tag, which has the data that's super important, that it was from the mountains. And there's actually no Olingos known from that high elevation. So he started to think this was a new species. He found a couple more in other museums, like scattered around. So no one had put it all together.
Yeah.
There was actually one that had written on the tag, new species, in pencil. And we sort of joked around that guy who did that must have got hit by a bus the next day or something, because he never followed through on it.
Right.
But it was a pretty obvious, sort of hiding in plain sight. And so we actually had an expedition together with some colleagues from Ecuador down to Ecuador and found that they're still alive there. And in fact, right as we were about to publish it, there's a bird lodge down in Ecuador that had olenguitos coming to their hummingbird feeder. And drinking the sugar water. And so we actually, you know, once we published this, we got lots of, it actually became a bit of a citizen science project because people were sending us pictures and saying, is this an olenguito or is this the olingo? And we could tell because they have this longer fur, they have different color. And so, you know, one of the super fun things was the next year after I published this paper, I got to take my kids down and show them this new species that we just described, you know, feeding at a hummingbird feeder in Ecuador.
Cute as a bug, these things. Now, it's kind of a raccoon-like animal, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's in the raccoon family. It lives in the trees, comes out at night, eats fruit. Some people have said it's like a hybrid between a cat and a teddy bear.
Yeah, no, it is. It is YouTube fodder, if ever there
was. Well, and in fact, it's, you know, it's important to point out that mammalogists are describing new species every year. Yeah. Normally, they're bats and rats. So I sort of say that our discovery was the first new cute mammal in about 30 years.
Anything that you'd actually want to see. You just returned from an expedition to Kenya a few weeks ago, and I think there again, the idea of keeping these specimens, you know, preserved was very important to your research. Tell us about your trip to Kenya.
Well, yeah. So the trip to Kenya was with some colleagues at the Smithsonian again, and we're going to the exact same places on Mount Kenya, which is it's an equatorial mountain. So it's on the equator. It's got glaciers at the top, but they're melting. Everyone can see that they're disappearing. And so climate change is clearly having an effect on this mountain. Well, in 1909, there was an expedition on Mount Kenya that collected a whole bunch of mammal specimens that are now at the Smithsonian. And that expedition was actually led by Teddy Roosevelt. So we were going to the exact same places. We have photographs from their expedition, and we have our tent in exactly the same place. And you can see the rock behind, the mountain behind, that we were in the same places. And so we were surveying mammals today to basically replicate what he had surveyed. So all his team actually was catching mice. And so we caught a lot of mice to compare. And one of the predictions is that they should be moving uphill. As it gets warmer, the vegetation and everything should be moving uphill. And there's a risk that the animals that are adapted to live at the top are going to run out of space. And then we also, so my team was actually in charge of running camera traps. And so we were running camera traps on a line from the bottom to the top. And in some ways, this was like the representation, the comparison for Teddy Roosevelt on horseback with his gun. Because, of course, he was there as a big game hunter, and he was shooting a lot of these animals. And those specimens are at the Smithsonian. And, you know, we don't collect like that anymore. But the camera traps are really great. And I actually really like them as kind of a modern, new type of collection that we can have at museums. And the camera trap picture gives you this voucher, right, which is so important in science, to be able to verify something,
yeah,
right? If you tell me you saw a mountain lion in your backyard, how can I check that, right? If you take a picture of something, then I can look at it. And so that's just like these drawers full of specimens, like the olenguito that was preserved as a skin or a skull. They're these vouchers. And camera traps do the same way without actually killing the animal, and actually in ways that we can get many, many more thousands and millions of pictures to sort of keep up with the pace of change that our planet is seeing right now.
And what about DNA testing, though, getting back to that? I mean, even with the olenguito, how important is that to also trap? And it looks different. The fur looks to be longer. It's redder, that sort of thing. So it's obviously different. Do you also do DNA testing?
Yeah. There's so many new techniques that are coming along that allow us to get more information, even out of these old specimens. And so DNA is one. Isotope analysis is another, where you can tell basically what the animals have been eating. Because sort of what comes in must get incorporated into the fur and the bones. And so there's always these new tests, which makes these museum specimens even more and more valuable every year.
But it's interesting to think about the olenguito, because, again, this has been something that was trapped in somebody's, you know, desk drawer for a couple of decades, several decades. Did you go back to did you do any DNA testing, and how did you track that?
Yeah, we did do some DNA testing, and that confirmed what the bones and the fur showed us as well, that they're way different. And the nice thing about DNA is there's so much more you can do with it in terms of you know, how many millions of years have they been separated. And now with the increasing genomic technology, we can start to actually tell like what genes they have and what those genes did. So we've actually been working some on that with coyote and dog and wolf hybridization, because a lot of the East Coast coyotes are actually hybrids with wolves and dogs.
Right.
And we've been able to show that they're about 80% coyote, 10% wolf, and 10% dog. And we're starting to look now at, like, what do those genes actually do? Like, what genes from the dog or the wolf are still in the coyote and how in the East, and what, how is that changing the animal?
And that certainly can tell you about environmental change and adaptation. What you kept was obviously important. That tells you something about the environment you're living in.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is what, you know, this Eastern coyote is the result of natural selection. This, you know, we didn't breed it this way.
Right.
This is just what survived in today's environment.
And the red wolf, too, you've also taken a look at that.
Yeah, we've done some work on the red wolf, looking at the hybridization between with coyotes, which is quite substantial.
When you you know, you talk about these 1909 specimens that you're comparing to, and I'm going back to Kenya now, and the mice collected by first Teddy Roosevelt, now you're going back 100 years, over 100 years later. Have you found anything yet, or are you just
Well, we're still the team is, I think, literally flying home from Kenya today, so we're still getting all the species lined up. We have some great camera trap pictures, which are super fun, and we have some more coming in. Actually, the cameras are going to keep running for another 2 months, so we'll be getting another. I'll be very excited in another 2 or 3 weeks. I'll get another upload from Kenya of pictures, and so we'll see what we've got there. So we're still counting up the species and seeing where they're at.
You know, but it leaves us with some very big questions outside of the research and what you can detect. The question of what to do about it. You know, we had a big conversation last week about, are we entering the Anthropocene era?
Oh, yeah.
Where we, yeah, sure, the coyote and the wolf naturally selected this crossbreed, but we're getting to the point where if we want to preserve things, we're going to have to intervene in ways that we never had before.
No, I think, you know, this concept of the Anthropocene, that we're living in a new world, and this is sort of the geologic era where humans are the main influence on the planet. There's no doubt that we're there. And, you know, increasingly my research questions are looking at how animals are affected by that. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's dire, for sure. Sometimes species are disappearing. But sometimes if you give animals a chance to hang around, they actually adapt. And they do. And the ones that survive are the ones that pass on their genes. And they change the behavior. And they change how they're making a living. And there are a lot of species. The coyote's a great example. And in fact, a lot of our citizen science camera trapping in Raleigh, where we have volunteers running cameras in their backyards or in the woods behind their house, they're showing that these animals are coming back into the cities. And actually, there's more wildlife, you know, living around us today than there ever has been before.
Because they're losing their habitat, and it's a little...
It's not just that they're losing their habitat. They're actually moving into our habitat. So species like the gray fox, we found in Raleigh, its favorite habitat is backyards.
I'm talking to Roland Kays today on The State of Things. He's the head of the Biodiversity Lab at North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. What do you mean? You would prefer it if you're losing your environment. You're saying that's not the only reason.
It's both, right. So yeah. These animals are actually changing. You know, here's all this habitat. Let's talk about suburban backyards. Loads of rabbits. Sometimes some fruit, some persimmon trees growing around there, often with, you know, maybe a little scrap of woods where they can have their den. And so we had volunteers run cameras in their backyards and in the woods near their house. And we got more pictures of gray fox in the backyards than we did in the woods behind. So
wow.
They're obviously using both. But, you know, this idea that there's a separation between humans and animals or that you know, we're driving them out of their habitat. I mean, in some cases that's true, but in some cases these animals are actually, you know, moving in. And I have to think in a lot of these cases, and with a coyote in Raleigh, this is definitely true. You know, every year they're getting more and more suburban.
What we're talking about this, you made many of these discoveries using citizen science. I know this is a big campaign these days through NC State and other institutions. Tell us more about the citizen science project and how it works.
Yeah, great. Well, I mean, scientists are starting to realize that non-scientists can collect useful data. And and we're still experimenting and finding, you know, there's some things they can't do, but there's some things that they really can do. And so we're starting to find, you know, how can we involve the public in our science? And there's two reasons that we like to do that. One is that often it can help us scale up and do things at a bigger scale if you crowdsource it. So we did a project looking at animals in 32 parks across 6 states running cameras in 2,000 locations, and that was all volunteers running these cameras. And if I had to go out to each of these 2,000 locations and run the camera and then pick it up a month later, you know, that would take a long time, or if I had to pay field assistance. But, you know, these people are excited because when you run a camera trap, you get to see all these animals, you know, firsthand. And checking the memory card on a camera trap is kind of like Christmas. And so that's one thing, is that it lets us ask new scientific questions. But then the other thing is it also, you know, helps people get outside, helps people connect with these animals. And we're actually, you know, in many, many times creating advocates when they realize, oh, wow, you know, there's animals actually in my backyard, or this park actually has bobcats. They get excited and they want to care and they want to protect it more.
It's one thing to say, I mean, you can see the advantages, but are there downsides? I mean, are there questions about credibility or reliability?
Yeah, you have to always consider that. And so that's one of the tricky things, for example, with bird watchers. There's a huge citizen science with effort with bird watchers, but you're counting on someone to be able to tell the difference between, you know, a black-throated blue and a black-throated green warbler call or something like that. And there are ways to filter through the data, and they get so many records that they can do some statistics to kind of weed out the outliers. But the great thing about camera traps is this voucher photograph thing that we were talking about before, where they're running this camera, which is basically a sensor. And they go through the pictures and they identify them, and then they send them to us through this project we call eMammal. And then we can go in and verify. We can double check everything. And so, you know, if they're not sure how to tell a red fox from a gray fox, we can double check that. And so we do get really, really good quality data. You know, the one thing we're counting on them to know how to use a GPS because we need the location. But once that is done, we can quality control everything.
Roland Kays, zoologist and director of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. You can check out a lot of what we're talking about and some photos at our website, stateofthings.org. And our conversation with Roland Kays continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Roland Kays, a zoologist and the head of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh, also teaches at NC State. We were talking a little bit earlier about the extreme mammal exhibit. Tell us more about that. What are we going to see?
Yeah, well, this is a great traveling exhibit that we brought in. It'll be here for about 6 months. And it's extreme mammals. So it's all the ways that mammals are really big or really small or really good at smelling or really loud or really quiet. And what I like about it is it kind of draws the boundaries around the group of mammals, which we are, you know, a member. And we're certainly very extreme in a number of ways, but not in every way. And so you can go in there and see a lot of amazing specimens. We have a replica of the largest land mammal that has ever lived on Earth, so it's way bigger than an elephant, and you can see that. And then right next to it is the smallest mammal that's ever lived on Earth. And so there's a lot of great specimens, a lot of great interactive things, and we've actually added a lot from our staff. So one of my colleagues has made a cool soundboard where you can, like, mix your own remix of mammal noises and play it. And we have some information about, like, the coyote research done at the museum, about the eMammal project. You can see some of the pictures that have been coming in. And we actually have a camera trap set up where you can get yourself camera trapped next to a giant bear.
Get you. Or in some other situation that if the NSA knew, well,
that's
never mind.
Right.
So let me tell you, the largest and smallest are very interesting to me for two different. You have to give us the scale of this largest mammal because, you know, the problem, right, the trade-off for mammals is they're warm-blooded. That's good news. We can now regulate ourselves. We're not so much victim of the temperature, the ambient temperature. Good news, but it takes a lot of energy. So you're about to tell me how big this animal is, and I'm asking you what it had to eat. Given the amount of energy you have to put out just to regulate your temperature.
Sure. Well, let me just say, to scale it, the most popular selfie to take in here is you looking up into the rear end of this animal. So if you're standing up, you're at about that height. And these guys are eating plants, just like the biggest dinosaurs ate plants. And one of the reasons we think they evolved so big, there's two reasons.
No, how big? How big are they? Give us a sense of the size of this animal.
Well, so if you stand up, you're at about the rear end of this animal.
That's an elephant to me. I mean, this is like four times the size of an elephant.
I don't have the exact numbers, probably about three times the size of an elephant.
Three times an elephant. Yeah. Okay, go
so
ahead.
It's not, it's not as big as the biggest dinosaurs, but it is bigger than an elephant, and it does look in some ways like a dinosaur. And, as to your question of why or how they evolved so big, there's two reasons. One is when you're eating these plants, you need to hold it in your belly and digest it for a long time because it's really hard to digest plants. You have to let the microbes do their work. You have to let the fermentation go and all that kind of stuff. So being big helped with that. But the other thing is just protection against predators. If you're that big, there's not very many predators that are big enough to get you. So there's kind of this arms race of growing bigger and bigger and bigger. And we find the same thing with elephants. There's lions cannot really take down an adult elephant because they're just so big.
Yeah, but just the sheer volume of food, if you're having to regulate your temperature and walk around. And
right,
find
but if you
stuff.
Can eat green stuff, the world is green. And so there's a lot of green stuff out there.
Or there was. Sadly, this animal is not with us anymore, and the smallest either. And this is a kind of an interesting animal, this little shrew-like animal that was probably among the very first mammals which cohabited with some of the last of the dinosaurs, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But we do have some animals that are actually pretty close in size to that. So the pygmy shrew is not much bigger than this tiniest shrew. And so there are still some really, really small animals still alive today, and it is amazing, and these guys have this super high metabolisms. So they're eating many times their body weight every day, and the shape of worms and insects and things.
What about you have also experience with some very small bats, right?
Yes, well, the smallest bat is the bumblebee bat, which is it's bigger than a bumblebee, but it's pretty small. And these are also insect eaters, flying around in this case in the Caribbean.
In the Caribbean. So you talked about working in Panama, and you did some great experiments with bees in Panama. Am I right?
Yeah. So a lot of my research has been animal tracking, and always trying to stay at the cutting edge of what tracking technology is available. And so when the first really small radio tracking tags came out, they were about 300 milligrams, and hardly anyone had tracked any insects at all. And so there was this big bee in Panama called the orchid bee, and it's very interesting because it collects smells from orchids. And and orchids are very rare. So the idea is that for it to find an orchid, it has to go a long way because they're rare. So they're not very dense. And in doing this, it should be an important pollinator for these orchids because it's going around doing this. But no one really knew how far they could fly. So we put these radio transmitters on them, and then we basically chased them around. And they didn't last very long, but they lasted about a week. And we had a team of undergraduates running around in Panama trying to keep up with these bees. And we couldn't keep up with them. They to some extent we could, but then we would lose them. So we actually ended up renting a helicopter and flying around, and we actually found that one of the bees had flown 5 kilometers away and actually crossed in this over the top of the Panama Canal, over the water, and gone into the forest and then came back to the island later. Wow. So these bees were really flying a long way, and you would never be able to do that without some kind of technology.
Right. Well, and the transportation technology, as you say, if you're having to track them even through the jungle or through a forest, that must be pretty rough business.
Yeah, we
fly.
Were literally running up and down the trails trying to keep up with them.
The other thing is that it's apparently using some kind of chemical sound. I mean, I guess we'd call it smell, right? So that's the distance at which this thing can detect if it's across the canal.
Well, it's definitely searching over those distances. Yeah. How far it can really detect it, I'm not sure. But certainly orchids have a strong smell.
But that's another series of questions that you can begin to ask about this. I mean, I guess, to a certain extent, smells involved here. How much also is pattern behavior? Has this bee flown that way before, or did it get messages from other bees and, sort of memorize that kind of data?
Yeah, certainly. There's a lot of questions that opened up. And we did have this – I remember this one bee in particular. He would start out the day at the same palm tree every day. So we would sort of go there, and then we would have the students – in different directions, ready to run, depending which way he flew that particular day to try to keep up with him.
And then I suppose at that point, I'd be interested in the weather and what the wind was doing that day to see what influence any of that might have had.
Yeah, you sound like a movement ecologist here. You're asking all the right questions about trying to understand, where animals go, what affects their movement. And these are the types of things that we're really entering a golden era of animal tracking because the technology is getting so good. We have GPS units now that will record the locality with really good accuracy. They'll send it back to you via text. text message. And we had this this great egret we were tracking in North Carolina in Madam Mesquite, and it was in the winter. And we were getting these text messages every day that it was here, it was here, it was here. And then one day it took off, and it flew all the way to New York in one night. And we checked the weather, and it had a 60-mile-an-hour tailwind. So your exact question of, is the weather important? In this case, it certainly was. This animal was flying at 60 miles an hour all the way from North Carolina to New York in one night.
I'm just imagining this egret sending me a text that says, just saw Mamma Mia, OMG.
Exactly.
But you didn't get that. Anyway, and also down in the Galapagos, I guess you were looking at the foraging patterns of an albatross.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was helping on that project. Unfortunately, I didn't actually get to the Galapagos myself, but working with a student who was studying the albatrosses, and so working with the tracking data and by combining it with a variety of other data sets. So this is one of the other great things we can do now is we have all these other satellite data about the winds, about the temperature, about things like ocean chlorophyll. And so this ocean chlorophyll layer shows you where the productive oceans are, where the most food is going to be. And so we found that these albatrosses were actually flying all the way to the coast of South America to forage and then fighting the wind to go back to the Galapagos.
So this seems to be a double-edged sword. I mean, on the one hand, you're gaining a lot of information about adaptation. That's telling you a lot about environmental change. Environmental change tends to worry us because most of the news about environmental change is bad news. The other side of that is these animals are adapting. And so, you know, the counter to should we do anything about climate change is, well, why don't we just adapt?
Yeah, no, I think, well, you have both happening. And I think studying this adaptation is key to help these animals because sometimes some animals are not making it. Some animals are not adapting fast enough because this pace of change is so fast. So this is what we worry about is that sure, you know, the globe has changed many times in the last 4 billion years and life has kept up, but this we know this pace of change is really fast. And so if we can study the animals that are adapting and figure out what do we need to do to give them a chance, and we know some of those things just from basic evolution about, you know, having the variation so that you happen to have some variant that, you know, knows how to cross a road without getting hit by a car or something like that, you know, that one will survive. But it's going to take a while for that to happen naturally.
I mean, it just seems to me the complicated questions it raises, and it's all good. It doesn't mean to stop the science. But if you think it through, on the one hand, you might conclude that this evidence can help you save the species, those species that you're studying. On the other hand, it might say, well, this is also evidence that we need to stop doing what we're doing or reverse some of the activity that's causing this acceleration in climate change. Or should we just adapt ourselves genetically as humans because we have some of that technology too? Complicated picture. And each piece of the puzzle you change, if you save more species, that's going to have an impact on the et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. But I think it's important also to see these examples as some sign of good news, that it's not all bad news. Not all species are going extinct or declining. There are some that are doing quite well, and of course, it varies in different parts of the world. But if you can show some species that made it, I mean, the bald eagle is a great example because it was so low and now it's doing so great. And we gave it time, we gave it some protection, we stopped the direct hunting of it, and that was needed, and now it's doing great. And I think there are examples around the world where, you know, give these animals a little bit of a break in terms of persecution, save a little bit of habitat, and they can stay with us in the long term.
There are a lot of biologists who think we're in the midst of something called the sixth extinction. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, so it's the, you know, extinction's when things disappear from Earth, and it's the sixth. If you look back over geologic time, you know, many, many billions of years ago, there have been a variety of things, the dinosaur extinction being the most famous one. When the asteroid hit the Earth and a lot of dinosaurs and other things went extinct. And, basically people think when you look back on the history of Earth in another million years, you're going to see this giant extinction period that happened, you know, when humans basically took over the planet. And, it's happening with mammals. It's happening with insects. It's happening, you know, because so much of the Earth is now dedicated to space for humans and not for the other species.
Can you tell? I mean, is there a rough history of North Carolina sort of pre-human and post-human? And just give us a kind of timeline sketch of how things have changed right here.
Well, it actually goes back, really pre-human, pre-Native American. There were, you know, mastodons and giant ground sloths. You can see the skeleton of the giant ground sloth at the Museum of Natural Sciences. This guy was in North Carolina. I mean, imagine this giant, you know, 12, 15 foot high creature, you know, chewing on trees. And it's pretty clear to, well, what I think happened is that humans hunted them all. You know, they would have been pretty easy prey. And if you're hungry, a giant ground sloth barbecue would be a pretty good way to go. So that was the first change, was we lost a lot of these giant animals. And then when Europeans colonized, we lost a couple more. We lost the cougar and the wolf, the red wolf, you know, for all intents and purposes. And now some animals are starting to come back. But there's also, you know, some of these species, especially some of the salamanders, some of the smaller species that are a little bit more sensitive, that aren't quite as mobile. You know, a lot of our wildlife is doing okay because it's very well managed. There's specific hunting season, trapping seasons. We make sure these animals are here. We have elk back in the state that were reintroduced. And so a lot of the bigger species are actually doing pretty well. Some of the smaller species, I think, are a little bit more concerned because they're more sensitive. And as climate change starts changing the way the forests, what type of forest these species that are specialized to, you know, a particular mountain cove in the Smoky Mountains, it's going to get too warm for them. And what's going to happen then? Are we going to move them to a newly suitable cove, or are we going to bring them into a zoo, or are we just going to let them disappear?
I am talking to Roland Kays today on The State of Things. He's head of the Biodiversity Lab at North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. He also teaches mammalogy at NC State. How has your field changed since you got into it?
Well, the field of studying mammals, certainly the technology has changed a lot. So when I got started, we were running camera traps with 36 rolls of film that could take 36 pictures. And so, you know, if a herd of deer camped out all night long, you were done collecting data because it would use up all the film. And so the digital camera traps are fantastic. And that's what we're, you know, now using with volunteers to run as well. Certainly the tracking technology has changed a lot in terms of the GPS. And both of these fields have started to hit what we call the era of big data, where it's not just, you know, a couple dozen data points. It's many, many hundreds of thousands, millions of data points, which are exciting because it allows us to ask new questions. But it also is hard because it becomes harder to analyze. And you Excel starts to bonk when you get that many data points, and a lot of the old methods don't even work anymore. Just to make like the home range of an animal, the old method completely bonks when you put in a million data points. And so we get all this great new detail, and we can really see what the animals are doing. But we also have to keep up on
data management has to
side.
Keep pace, right?
Yes.
You've got to expand that field as well. So if I want to get involved as a citizen scientist, what do I do?
Yeah, well, so we have two citizen science projects, running out of my lab. The eMammal project is the main one, where we're having volunteers run cameras. We're especially looking right now for volunteers in more rural areas because we have quite a lot of suburban data, and we want to know what's going on out in the more rural counties. So we're looking for volunteers in that project. We also have a cat tracking project where we have volunteers putting little GPS units on their cats if they let them outdoors. Now, generally, we suggest you don't let your cat outdoors because there are a lot of coyotes out there, and cats are doing damage to the bird populations. But if you do let it outdoors, we're interested in where it goes. And so there's this cat tracking project as well.
Roland, what a pleasure. So great to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me in.
Roland Kays, a zoologist and director of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. The exhibit Extreme Mammals is on display through next March at the museum. You can find out more and see some pictures at our website, stateofthings.org. Tomorrow, we will be in Greensboro at the Triad Stage. You can be part of the live audience tomorrow afternoon in Greensboro. If you want to find out how to do that, and how to RSVP, you can go to our website, WUNC.org, and join us in the audience tomorrow in Greensboro. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.